This is Rich Mahogany, and this is number 0160, the Stuff File Program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it starts right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
There, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0160. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, you'll meet former NYPD cop J.P. Pompicello, who is the author of The Inner Shield.
It's about what it feels like to put the uniform on. You know, that's why I call it the inner shield. You got a shield on the outside, but you got a shield inside. What it feels like. And it's the strangest thing, because all of a sudden, you're in a city of 11 million people, and they're all looking at you. It's a little scary when you think about it.
Dr. Trevor Campbell is the co-author of The Grandparents' Handbook.
Grandparents have changed, and grandchildren have changed, in the sense that grandparents have become far more active. They're healthier at any given age. They do more things. They're the ones at the Rolling Stone rock concert. Their grandchildren can't afford it. And the grandchildren see them as kind of self-sufficient, having a good life.
Stuart Nullman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and we're going to get some satisfaction on Book Banter with a new biography of Mick Jagger. So start me up. It's coming soon on the Stuff File Program.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0160, was Rich Mahogany, the co-host of The Naughty Wood Show, a music show heard Saturdays on CyberStationUSA.com. You can check their website for listings, and you'll find the link to their website on TheStuffFile.com. And thank you very much, Rich, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. A program that is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, Pennsylvania State Police said that they arrested a man caught on camera stealing a toilet from a store and immediately returning the item to the store for store credit. Now, investigators said Bobby Clifford Smith III, age 32, was caught on camera August 28th, taking the toilet from a Lowe's Home Improvement store in Somerset and going directly to the customer service line, where he exchanged the toilet for $667.34 in store credit without presenting a receipt. Smith was arraigned on a retail theft charge and held in lieu of $30,000 bail. Now, that is the definition of chutzpah. I mean, really, trying to steal something, trying to return something, rather, to a store that you haven't even left with it. I mean, you're still in the store, you're stealing the toilet, or at least you want the money for the toilet. That is chutzpah. But, you know, he's going to spend time in the can for trying to steal a can. So, go figure. Irony. Anyway, a New York strip club is hoping to dodge a huge tax bill by claiming its lap dances are a work of art. Night Moves argues its so-called couch sales are live dramatic or musical arts performances equivalent to theater or ballet. Okay, Andrew McCullough, an attorney for the club, said, "If you saw what these dancers do, you'd be saying, it's not the Bolshoi, but it's good." Yeah, to which I respond, yeah, Bolshoi indeed. That's just vulgar. Anyway, the strip club's bid to be spared $400,000 in back taxes is being backed by a cultural anthropologist who has studied exotic dance and visited Night Moves. I bet he has. Arguments were heard at the city's Court of Appeals, and a decision on whether the club should be charged tax is due next month. Now, it's definitely a form of art, one dancer at Night Moves said. Well, of course. What else is the dancer going to say? Some girls are up there practicing for hours when nobody's in here, But state solicitor Robert Goldfarb said, if the women kept their clothes on, no one would be coming to this bar for the dance performances. A ruling in favor of night moves could spark a wave of tax claims from the estimated 200 adult nightclubs across the state. I don't know. You know, if this thing ever managed to go to trial and there was a jury, all it would take to quash this case would be one woman on that jury. And then we're done, I think, because you'd have to think that this thing has gotten so far because it's all being argued by just men. Anyway, this story certainly brings new meaning to the term poll tax. And police in London, Ontario, were called to investigate several men driving around with booze on a motorized picnic table. I couldn't make this up if I tried. Sure enough, when officers arrived, they found the picnic table parked on the sidewalk. The men had equipped it with four wheels and a lawnmower engine. The group's ringleader, an unnamed 46-year-old man, was cited with having an open container of liquor in a public place. It is at least a brilliant way to keep one step ahead of the ants, I guess, if you're having a picnic. A Rhode Island woman swearing cockatoo is ruffling the feathers of her neighbors, her ex-husband, and his new girlfriend. That's who lives next door. Lynn Taylor and her profane parrot named Willie are accused of violating the City of Warwick's animal noise ordinance. Now, Willie allegedly called the girlfriend Kathleen Melker a whore repeatedly. Melker claims her boyfriend's ex trained the bird to swear at her and also pelted rocks at her over the fence and threatened to drown her cat. The dispute has been going on for a year. Taylor argued in court that the ordinance is vague and unconstitutional, but the judge refused to dismiss the case against her. Okay, now, what I want to know is if there is that much animosity between exes. I mean, remember, they were married, they're now exes. Then why are they living next door to each other? This is just like a bad sitcom. There's no need for this. Anyway. We have time for one more item before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Here's a news flash. You can order yourself an assault rifle on Amazon and have it delivered right to your door. Just ask Seth Horvitz of Washington, D.C. Only problem is Seth had ordered a flat-screen TV when the rifle showed up instead. The TV had been purchased by a third-party seller. An invoice showed that the gun was intended for delivery to a firearms dealer in Duncansville, Pennsylvania. So Mr. Horvitz called police, who took the gun and are investigating how the mistake was made. Amazon and UPS have no immediate comment. Except maybe to say, oopsie. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? J.P. Pompicello is a retired NYPD cop who saw the city through the violent troubles there in the late 60s and 70s. He's the author of a new book about the emotional life of a cop. It's called The Inner Shield. And J.P. joins us on the line with us from Boston right now. Hi, J.P.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on the program with us. As I mentioned in the introduction, you certainly were a cop in what was probably some of the most turbulent times in New York City.
You know, it was, I laughed, but it was real. I didn't realize how bad it was until you get off it. You know, then you realize that you were in a hornet's nest. You know, you never know that.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. How did you decide to become a cop in the first place?
Well, you know, I was a bricklayer in the union, and they were so crooked, and my father-in-law fought them. So they made us work outside, and he fell off a building and got killed, and I fell four times off a scaffold. And I figured if I'm going to die, I might as well die as a cop. At least my wife will get a pension.
So then, in other words, you didn't go to the life of a police officer in the traditional route. You didn't start very young because you already were in a different profession when you decided to become a police officer.
Yes, I was 25, so I was much more mature than a lot of the younger ones.
Now, what was the biggest surprise or biggest hurdle for you when you decided to become a police officer? Because everyone has a misconception of what the life of a police officer is like. So what was the biggest misconception that you came across?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, that's why I wrote The Inner Shield. It's about what it feels like to put the uniform on. You know, that's why I call it the inner shield. You got a shield on the outside, but you got a shield inside. What it feels like. And it's the strangest thing, because all of a sudden, you're in a city of 11 million people, and they're all looking at you. It's a little scary when you think about it.
How long were you a police officer?
I was 15 years. I got hurt. It was a couple of cops tried to kill me, and I was in a knife fight. And, of course, they didn't get locked up in those days. That's how bad it was. It was about narcotics.
Wow. So at what point did you decide, I need to write this book?
Well, you know, I wrote it for my grandchildren. I wanted to know who I was, so that's why I decided to write the book. And I figured, well, you know, a policeman is a good time to write it because they'll get an idea. And, you know, in the book, I'm not such a good guy and I'm not a bad guy. I'm a real person. And what it feels like to be a policeman. And a lot of people who read my short stories, they just love it because they become me and they know what it feels like. They get that feeling of what it's like to walk the streets and be a person walking the streets. You know, I always thought if you put the uniform, you'd be somebody else. But it's always you. You're always the same person.
Yet, as you just described, you say you wanted your grandkids to get to know you. And a police officer, unlike most professions, tends to be one of those jobs that defines a person. You can do all kinds of things in life, but if you were a police officer and you then stop being a police officer, you will always be referred to as a former police officer.
Yes, it stays with you. You know, it's almost like I wrote a screenplay called Once a Marine. You know, once you're a policeman, you're always a policeman, especially a New York policeman. Just can't get away from it.
Now, we often hear stories. Now, again, it was the tough times in the 60s and 70s, as we described, but we often hear stories that being a police officer certainly is not like being on television, where they seem to draw their gun every second episode, if not more. But a lot of times, police officers never draw their weapon. Now, what was it like in your case?
Well, you know, I happened to be undercover, and I had a lot of bad situations, so I did have to draw my gun, and unfortunately, I was in shootouts. But a lot of policemen never did draw their gun. They did 20 years and never pulled their gun out. People think, you know, you just shoot up. It's not that you don't shoot up as much as you think you do. Only in the movies, everybody's disappointed when you tell them, they ask you, how many people did you kill? I think they're crazy when they ask me a question like that.
Now, you said you did some undercover work. Is undercover something that you were drawn to or they asked you to do? How do you go from being what I would assume initially is a beat cop to doing undercover?
Yeah, that's right. I wasn't like the other policemen. Because I was much older, and in those days I was dressed like a hippie, and the inspectors didn't like me. So when they needed somebody, they picked me because I was, you know, natural. You know, I used to buy drugs. I was doing drugs. And then being I was a bricklayer, I knew the union. I infiltrated the mafia also. So I was spread out because of my personality and the way I dress. I didn't wear a Hawaiian shirt, you know, like the other cops used to do.
At the time you were doing undercover work, were you also at that time a married man?
Well, that's when you get divorced. You don't know who you are after a while. You know, one minute you're this person, the next minute that you're that person. You are locking people up who become your friends. You're just not normal. It's hard to be married under those conditions. You just lose it. You literally lose who you are. And it's hard to be a good husband.
I mentioned in the introduction that the book is about the emotional life of a cop. Is it virtually impossible at the end of the day? I mean, you can take the badge off, but do you ever remove the badge?
No, that's why I call it the inner shield. Also, you'll carry that the rest of your life. You know it's so hard because you're in such a big city, and all of a sudden you're getting into situations that people are trying to kill you. And then the tour is over with, and then you go home and sit down and try to have, you know, a dinner. It's like you're sitting there and you're saying, boy, some people just try to kill me today. And it's not normal.
So how
and
do
your feelings.
How
what happens? Okay, I'm sorry.
Sorry, how do you cope with that? And is that something you get help with while on the job? Is that something that requires help after the job? How do you deal with that?
Well, you know what happens? You're trained not to show emotions because, you know, if there's a riot, you don't want to show people what's going on. If there's a fire, you don't want to scare anybody. If somebody's in a car accident or dying, you stay almost monotone and you just talk to them because people are watching you to see how you're reacting. What happens, you stuff everything down and you don't realize you're doing that. And then when you leave the police department, it all comes up. And that's when my post-traumatic stress came up after I left the police department.
By writing this book, are you trying to reach the general population to let them know what it's like to be a cop? Are you trying to reach current cops? Are you trying to reach future cops?
Well, you know, it does a little bit of everything. People who haven't been policemen loved reading, and policemen get a kick out of it because once they read it, they start telling you war stories about their life. And some of them, I have a cousin who's a homicide sergeant, and we're talking, and he says his nightmares are worse than the bodies he sees now. And that's what happens. So everybody, I think Whoopi should read this book. You know, in the police academy, they should get an idea what happens.
Now, you are, if I'm not mistaken, you are currently married to a therapist, correct?
Yes.
And your wife,
she helped me out immensely.
Your wife deals with victims of violence. I'm just curious to know if, for you, if writing this book was a cathartic experience.
Yeah, you know, you're right. I didn't know it at the time when I started. When I started writing it, all the stuff, all my anger and pain started coming up. I didn't realize that was going to happen. My wife encouraged me to finish the book. I didn't want to finish it. She encouraged me because it was like therapy. And it helped me out immensely, and I think it's going to help young cops to read it and people to look at policemen differently. You know, when they see a policeman in the street, they'll look at him a little differently. They'll think about the funny things that happen to you.
Hindsight is always 20/20. You are married to a therapist. Writing this book is cathartic. Do you think she knew what she was doing when she encouraged you to write this book?
Yeah, that's my wife's not here, so I can say, hey, you know, I think she knew what she was doing, but she never told me. I think that's the funny part. I'm sorry I'm laughing because it was very painful, but she knew what she was doing. I didn't know what she was doing. And so that encouragement was very helpful for me. I mean, she really taught me so much about life just by reliving my life.
Now that you know all that you know, and as you say, you've relived this life and you've written the book, The Inner Shield, if you had the opportunity to go back, would you do it again?
You know, I think so. You know how women have babies and then 6 months later they forget what it's like to pain? I think, well, you see, I give lectures now. I give a lot of lectures and I train people in the movie business. It's still feeling like being a policeman.
Well, why do you think you would go back? What was the attraction, the draw?
Well, you know what the big draw was? It's helping people. You know, I always tell the story where you start off and you deliver a baby, you catch a robber, you help kids cross the street, and then you stop a car and you give them a ticket, and they yell at you and they say, why don't you catch a crook? And you don't say nothing, what happened to you all day. And it's a job that you don't ask for credit from the public. You just want to help the public.
People can learn more about it by reading your book. The book is called The Inner Shield. And JP, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed talking to you, Peter.
JP Pompicello, author of The Inner Shield. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0160, and you'll find links to Amazon.com where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. You know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
From the land that brought you maple syrup, poutine, ice hockey, and Pamela Anderson, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come in the program, we will talk about grandparents with the co-author of The Grandparents Handbook. Plus, Stuart Nullman is along once again with another edition of Book Banter. And you know there's going to be, a little later on, an idiot of the day. Well, right now we have more Stuff File news for you on the Stuff File program, which is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio. And you know, as far as Stitcher is concerned, on-demand news, talk, and more is right at your fingertips. And when I'm saying fingertips, right on your mobile phone. The latest episode is always available to you. No syncing needed, no memory or storage wasted. It's available on your iPhone, iPad, Android phones, and beyond. Basically, any mobile device you've got, you can listen to Stitcher Smart Radio. Downloading is easy. Just go to Stitcher.com, and or you could also check out your favorite app store. And, you know, I've been saying on the program time and time again that you have an opportunity to hear well over 5,000 shows, different shows, on Stitcher Smart Radio. Well, I think I've slightly underestimated it, or actually not so much an underestimation, the fact that Stitcher is growing so quickly, because now you can hear over 10,000 shows. 10,000 different shows, including The Stuff File, on Stitcher Smart Radio. You know, Stitcher Smart Radio is the smarter way to listen to radio. Anyway, let's get right back to the stuff, shall we? Well, thanks to more marketing creativity, we now have just the thing for extreme ultra-Orthodox Jewish men who shun contact with the opposite sex. These are special glasses that blur their vision so they don't have to worry about accidentally seeing a woman they consider to be immodestly dressed. In an effort to maintain their strictly devout lifestyle, the ultra-Orthodox have separated the sexes on buses, sidewalks, and other public spaces in their neighborhoods. Their interpretation of Jewish law forbids contact between men and women who are not married. Walls in their neighborhoods feature signs exhorting women to wear closed-necked long-sleeve blouses and long skirts. The glasses provide clear vision for up to about a few feet so as not to impede movement, but anything beyond that gets blurry, including women. It's not known how many have been sold, but hey, at least they're a bargain, selling for only $6. You know, that's like permanent beer goggles. That's what that is. Anyway, Moving right along, much to the dismay of the Cambodian people and the parliament, Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen just set a new personal best when he spoke to a lower house of parliament in a nationally televised speech that was mandatory viewing for civil servants. That's right, everyone was legally required to watch all 5 hours and 20 minutes. Wow. A government spokesman said he believed it was Hun Sen's longest speech in 27 years as prime minister. The 61-year-old spoke without taking breaks or questions, mostly on sensitive border disputes with Vietnam. He blamed France, the former colonial ruler of both countries, for not clearly demarcating the border. But for the record, his speech was far from the lengthiest among world leaders. Former Cuban leader Fidel Castro, who definitely had a case of verbal diarrhea when he spoke, frequently made five-hour speeches outdoors in the hot Caribbean sun in his heyday. And Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, no slouch with words himself, spoke for 9 hours in his State of the Union speech back in January. Okay, after a speech is done on television, is it the same thing like what happens here in North America? Do television pundits have to analyze the speech on the air for the next several hours? That must be one dull broadcast. That must make C-SPAN look like porn. Anyway, in Portland, Oregon, 34-year-old Jose Romero Valenzuela of Las Vegas managed to get himself 3 speeding tickets in less than an hour. First, at 105 miles per hour, then at 98 miles per hour, and finally at 92 miles per hour. Well, at least he was slowing down. After the final ticket, Jose decided it might just be wise to drive at the speed limit, which is posted at 65. Along with $2,000 in fines and penalties, police say his license could be suspended for up to 90 days if he's found guilty on the citation alleging driving in excess of 100 miles per hour. That would be the first ticket. The worst part is the reason he was driving so fast was he wouldn't be late for his court date to face charges of possessing meth. Wow. Okay. I think the loser tag can officially apply to this guy. That's all I'm saying. Moving right along, Emmanuel Kavakos, age 56, was arrested in April and charged with sending 2 Chicago sports team executives emails that threatened them with violence for having stolen his ideas for winning championships. Now, one of the victims was a former general manager of the Chicago Cubs. That's right, the Chicago Cubs, a team that famously has not won a National League championship in 66 years, nor a World Series in 103. This is some guy who's definitely unclear on the concept. And while we're speaking of unclear on the concept, in April, Arizona, recently the home of cutting-edge legislation, almost set itself up for the impossible task of trying to prohibit any annoying or offensive or profane language on the internet. Well, good luck with that. The state house passed a bill which was endorsed 30-0 by the state senate, ostensibly to make an anti-stalking telephone regulation applicable to digital communications. Just as the bill was about to go to the governor for signature, sponsors suddenly realized the futility of the bill's directives, and on April 4th, they withdrew it. Well, at least they came to their senses. Briefly, in this one case. But then, I'm always reminded that there's that Russian proverb that says, even a broken clock is right twice a day. So you can't let them off the hook too much for that one. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here with me, Peter Anthony Holder, on the Stuff File program, federal court documents revealed in March that Army Private Brandon Pierce, age 28, had convinced Citibank in January that he spoke for Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen, one of the world's richest men, and convinced the bank to issue Allen, i.e. Price, a new debit card and to change Allen's address from Seattle to Price's address in Pittsburgh. Price/Allen shopped decidedly downscale, running up charges only at GameStop and Family Dollar, totaling less than $1,000. I remind you, he was AWOL from the U.S. military. But again, as I said in a previous story, going into a bank and getting them to give you a card, a debit card, under the name of Paul Allen, one of the richest men in the world, that takes chutzpah. Also, on behalf of Citibank, I have to hope that whoever issued this card has been fired. Anyway, on to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Technology and the nuclear family have changed so much in the last few decades that many grandparents are left sitting on the outside looking in on the lives of their grandchildren. But according to Dr. Trevor Campbell, these changes are exactly the reasons why more grandparents should be getting more involved. Dr. Campbell is the co-author of The Grandparents' Handbook, and he joins us on the line right now from British Columbia. Hi, Trevor.
Hi, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So, you have
Thanks
studied.
For having me.
Thank you. You have studied the role of grandparents. How has it changed, first of all, from the current crop of grandparents to the previous generation, or from the previous generation?
Well, I think what's happened is that grandparents have changed and grandchildren have changed in the sense that grandparents have become far more active. They're healthier at any given age. They do more things. They're the ones at the Rolling Stone rock concert. Their grandchildren can't afford it. And the grandchildren see them as kind of self-sufficient, having a good life. On the other hand, the grandchildren appear kind of removed from them, seem to be more interested in social networking devices. They still love their grandchildren, of course, but they somehow feel that the word used very often, or the expression, is we're somehow missing the boat. And this is often given in the context of feeling guilty that they're even bringing it up.
Now, do you think that the grandparents today, the change you've described about grandparents today, is that universal, or are grandparents different depending upon what culture or background you come from?
Yes, I would say there are definite cultural differences and probably regional differences. I'm dealing mainly with urban middle income to upper income, fairly well-educated people, and what they report in other during counseling for other conditions, this leaks out into the interview, and that was what motivated me to write this book, co-author it with Shirley Bell.
Who did you see as your primary audience for this book? Who were you trying to reach? Were you trying to reach the grandparent? Were you trying to reach the grandchildren, or were you trying to reach that generation in the middle?
I'm really aiming at grandparents, and hence the name, The Grandparents' Handbook, How to Connect with Your Grandkids. But really, what it's about is how to save yourself a whole lot of pain and frustration of having that feeling that you're not getting where you want to be in the relationship, the disappointment that they describe, missing the boat, so to speak. Now, the reason grandparents today, I think, are as needed as ever, or even more so, is that we are inundated with information. But knowledge is information with context. And grandparents are great individuals to provide context or a meaning frame. And we have to remember that insight is knowledge with context and experience, and grandchildren are fairly low on experience because of their age, and therefore context, or how we make meaning out of things, how we frame things, becomes vitally important.
Do you find that generationally speaking, grandparents, even though they might be more quote-unquote hip to the room, nowadays grandparents seem to be slightly older because people are having children older, which means their children are having children older, which means grandparents are older?
That's correct. There is that difference as well. But the grandparents, if I think back, if I may, just give you some information from my past. When my grandmother, when my grandfather died, my grandmother wore a lot of dark clothes. I sort of attended family functions, led a quiet life, and we visited her because we liked her. It was much lower key. There weren't these expectations, these demands, and everybody seemed pretty happy with that. Now it's kind of, the meetings appear to be tangential, limited time, and less frequent. And this is kind of regretted by a lot of the grandparents I speak to.
Now, I'm at the tail end of the baby boom myself. The front end of the baby boom generation is the generation that are now the grandparents. And one of the things you can say about baby boomers in general, and I'm not saying this as a negative, I'm actually saying this as a positive, is that baby boomers, for a certain degree, kind of refuse to grow up. Which I say that as a positive, not a negative. Do you think that changes the way they are grandparents as well?
Yes, I do. I think that I also see it as a good thing. But you see, my grandmothers, they kind of led a circumscribed life just because they were quiet people, and that was kind of the done thing at the time. Now this generation, the baby boom generation, wants it all. I mean, on all fronts, and this has impact on various things as we see now. But they just feel that all the ingredients are there, but it's not happening. In fact, I've had a very articulate grandmother say to me, "Dr. Campbell, it's almost as if the devices and the electronics are replacing the relationships. You know, we'll talk, got to go now," kind of thing. They appreciate the contact, any contact, but it's not. There is a disconnect between how fulfilling the experience is from the grandparents' point of view.
One of the things that is different between our grandparents' lives and the lives of current grandparents is the media and also the technology as you describe it. I mean, the parents who are grandparents today, they grew up with books like Dr. Spock. There was a whole shift in how to parent. So if there's naturally a shift in how to parent, wouldn't that naturally lead to a different shift in how to grandparent?
It would. One of the things that I did, I agree with that statement, firstly, but one of the things I would like to mention at this point is that a lot of the grandparents report a kind of reticence because they don't want to cause problems in the relationship or for the parents. Because we live in an age of admonition, you know, experts everywhere. And what this book tries to do, it looks at the basics, and I think it succeeds in that, and it suggests that we trust our instincts. Grandparents were made to grandparent. These are the principles. And go with the flow. Don't be held back by, well, you're not a psychologist, or you're not this, or you're not that. You're a grandparent. And if I may put this in, there's this favorite fable of mine about the centipede and the praying mantis. The praying mantis says to the centipede, how on earth do you walk with 100 legs? The centipede said, it's easy. All I do is this. And as he said it, he stumbled. The whole point is, if you make it too self-conscious, it's forced and unsatisfying. And I like that anecdote. It usually goes down pretty well as well.
Now, I know we can't necessarily predict the future, but I do want you to, you know, use your crystal ball a little bit. As I described, the different parenting styles of the past generation leads to different grandparenting styles in this generation. A lot of today's parents have been considered or called helicopter parents, that sometimes they spend too much time or are overly attentive to their children. How do you think that generation will be as grandparents?
Oh, it's hard to say, you know. I think what we've seen, I mean, I hear from parents who feel very judged if they miss a single soccer match of their child. You know, one only hopes that people don't burn out in this very stressful process, and then, you know, going on to be more like previous grandparents were. It's hard to say, actually. You know, I see all kinds of situations, but I do think the child needs its peers as well. Mm. You know.
A grandparent can also have a positive impact on things like a child's self-esteem, a child's character, and also a sense of where they come from beyond just the generation before them.
Yes, absolutely. The context. Yeah, I would agree with that completely. And self-esteem is incredibly important because it both enables and protects the child through their entire life, really, giving them the courage to pursue their goals and dreams, but also being resilient to negativity and abuse. It's really a core value, and I make a big deal about it in counseling.
And I also think one thing a lot of people don't necessarily consider or think about is that children, because they are being parented by their parents and to a certain degree ruled, are also watching very closely the dynamic between their own parent and their parent.
You're absolutely right. They're watching like hawks, actually. Do you know, their eyes sort of slide above the mobile device, but they are listening. I can believe me. I would agree with that.
The book is called The Grandparent's Handbook. How can one get the book?
It can just be bought directly from Amazon.com. The Grandparent's Handbook, subtitle How to Connect with Your Grandkids, by Shirley Bell and Trevor Campbell.
Dr. Campbell, I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. It's a most interesting topic indeed. I'm sure your grandparents would have been proud.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Dr. Trevor Campbell, co-author of The Grandparents' Handbook, How to Connect with Your Grandkids. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0160, and you'll find links to Amazon.com where you can order his book directly for the Kindle. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. A lawyer in Texas has just filed a lawsuit over injuries he claims his client received after sitting on a hot bench. The main facts of the case are not disputed. The bench is made of black marble, was exposed to the bright sun on a day when the temperature reached 100 degrees, and is located on property owned by the Dallas Cowboys football team. Even though most people would say it's obvious that a bench like that could get very hot in those conditions, the lawyer says the Cowboys are liable because they did not put a warning sign on the bench saying it could get hot in the bright sun. Let's be fair, the lawyer claims his client received very serious burns, and that's no laughing matter. But this case will test the long-held legal principle that there is no duty to warn about things that are open and obvious. It's a principle based on common sense and personal responsibility, and now the court must decide if those time-honored values still have a place in America. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nallman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And yes, we do indeed have Stuart Nallman, who, trust me, gathers no moss. He's with us again. Hello, sir.
Hello, Peter. You want me to do the... Hello, Peter. I'm Mick Jagger. Can you see me doing Satisfaction? Dun, 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 dun. All right. Well,
yeah.
After all that, I guess it's no great shakes to say that on this edition of Book Banter, we're going to look at a book about not just Rolling Stones, but Mick Jagger. Can you believe they're turning 50 this year, Peter?
You mean the band, because they're way over 50.
Yeah, that's right. 50 years ago, the world's greatest band in rock and roll started. That's Rolling Stones. And I can't believe that's, you know, some of those guys are still around, especially Keith.
Well, you know, there are Beatles fans who might disagree with your terminology as the world's greatest band.
Yeah, exactly. But that was the tag they were always identified as.
Yes. Actually.
And throughout those 50 years, with so many incarnations, personnel changes, hit singles and albums, world tours, tragedies and controversies, the Stones have always one consistent aspect to it, and that's their lead singer and frontman who has been singularly identified with the group, Mick Jagger. or his original first name was Mike. That's what his mom always called him. Part rock legend, part womanizing Lothario, part devil incarnate, Jagger has carved out a place for himself in rock music history with such memorable hits as Satisfaction, Jumpin' Jack Flash, Painted Black, and Start Me Up. His distinctive singing voice and his trademark onstage body moves and gyrations that people have compared to a rooster on speed. But the personal side of Mick Jagger has also been a subject of controversy and fascination with his fans and the general public, whether it be his sexuality or his on-again, off-again battles with close friend and Stones Lee guitarist Keith Richards. Now, Christopher Anderson, who over the past 20 years has penned a series of best-selling celebrity biographies that have dealt with such figures as Madonna, Barbara Streisand, John F. Kennedy Jr., and Princess Diana, has tackled the wild personal and professional life of Mick with lurid fascination in his latest bio titled Mick. Now, the book chronicles nearly 70 years in the life of this rock legend. It's not a biography that deals with Jagger and the music of the Rolling Stones. It mainly deals with the type of offstage details that would satisfy those readers who crave celebrity gossip. For example, there's Jagger's need to be a control freak, especially throughout the 1960s, when the unstable founder of the band, the late Brian Jones, whose unpredictable violent behavior gave Jagger an excuse to quietly push him out of the band in 1969.
Is that really being a control freak, or is that just simply self-preservation?
Well, a little bit of both, but he...
I mean, is it a control freak if you're right? You know?
Well, I guess there were... I mean, also, don't forget, at the time when Brian Jones was with the band, he was one of the most popular members of the band, especially with the female fans. So maybe Jagger was a little bit jealous as well. That's very possible.
Yeah.
If you're going
on the cuteness level of it, it's not like Jones had a lot of competition there.
No, definitely not.
I mean, they do, especially as they've aged. There is a certain gargoyle quality to the Rolling Stones.
Oh yes, you see the last photo of Mick in the photo section of the book. Gargoyle just doesn't begin to describe it. Scary, it does, actually. But then there's Jagger, the notorious womanizer, who boasted to have slept over 4,000 women. Anderson gives a lot of pages and interesting details to the volatile affairs he has had, whether it be with model Chrissy Shrimpton, singer Marianne Faithfull, whose toxic affair with Jagger led to a suicide attempt, Bianca Jagger, of course, Jerry Hall, Angelina Jolie, and Carla Bruni. Anderson argues that Jagger was a very needy person who would incessantly call a woman after the initial encounter and would weep uncontrollably like a deprived, codependent individual if the relationship ended after a brief or prolonged fling.
No, I believe he was just crying when he pees. That's
well, maybe today. Oh yeah, it's true. Maybe back in his heyday of the 70s.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, I can see the inspirations of some songs that could have been. Uh-huh. And, of course, what biography of Mick Jagger is complete without mentioning his tempestuous personal and professional relationship with Keith Richards? They were known as the Glimmer Twins. Anderson gives it a good deal of coverage, especially how one day they're bitter enemies, and the next they're the best of friends. This is evident in 2002 when Richards was furious at the fact that Jagger received a knighthood. According to Richards, he admitted that I went berserk bananas and threatened to withdraw from the upcoming 40 Licks tour. But Anderson admits that no matter what went on between the two of them, their respective loyalty to the Rolling Stones was always in question and never wavered. Mick, the book, is an entertaining biography of the former London School of Economics student who always felt that need to entertain. And through hard-driving rock music, a touch of androgyny, and plenty of excess and controversy, he defined the face of rock music for nearly half a century and turned the street-fighting man into a true rock legend.
Could you imagine when the Queen got the list of the people she had to knight that year and she was going, really? We've reached this far down the list?
Well, to be honest with you, the Queen was conspicuously absent the day that Jagger got knighted and led the duties to Prince Charles, who is a big Stones fan.
Of course.
Yeah. Just conspicuously absent. She had to go to Balmoral for some strange reason.
Yes, I believe she had to grout the tub.
Yeah, and there's a lot of tubs to grout in that place. But if you want to read up a little bit more, I do recommend Keith Richards' autobiography, Life, which is a terrific book, and a lot of great behind-the-scenes stories about him and with Jagger and with the group, and also about stories behind some of the greatest songs. And also, next month, Philip Norman is an excellent rock journalist who's written some excellent in-depth biographies of the Beatles and John Lennon, is going to be putting out a biography of Mick Jagger also, which is supposed to be a really in-depth look at Jagger's life and career. So look out for that one next month.
By the way, I think I misspoke. I said the Queen was grouting the tub. Of course, we know she wouldn't do that. She was giving one of the corgis an enema, I believe.
And there's a lot of corgis to give enemas to in Balmoral. Oh, I tell you. But an interesting book, this one by Christopher Anderson. But if you want a not more in-depth book, just wait for Philip Norman's biography to come out in October.
And the book is called, once again?
It's called Mick by Christopher Anderson. It's published by Gallery Books, and it's $29.99.
And should someone want to read something of similar vein, perhaps maybe even... what's-his-face's book? Richard's book, too, I guess would be another one to look at, right?
Yes, exactly. And I did review that on Book Banter.
I remember, yes.
Yeah, in paper at in the West End Times, or if you want to see it, the archive or the current issue, you can see it online at www.westendtimes.ca.
Thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome, Peter, and now just start me up. Because when you start me up, I'll never stop.
There you go. Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're almost out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do, of course, have an idiot of the day coming your way. But before we get to that, a couple more Stuff File stories to share with you. When a Daytona Beach, Florida police officer tried to pull over Marvin Morris Jr., age 29, he allegedly made a run for it. Morris sped away but crashed into a tree. He then attempted to run, but according to the arrest affidavit, his baggy shorts fell down around his ankles twice, tripping him the second time. Now, because of his awkward wear, the officer was able to catch up to him and taser him and make the arrest. Morris was convicted of trafficking in cocaine, attempting to flee or elude law enforcement, driving on a revoked license, and possession of marijuana. So he was either high, stoned, or stupid. Quite possibly all three. Somebody who was a candidate for Idiot of the Day, but nope. That comes later. 19-year-old Dylan DeFalco may have been a football star at his Fort Myers, Florida high school, but he apparently never learned how to treat police officers. After being arrested on a misdemeanor battery charge, DeFalco allegedly urinated in the back of the patrol car bringing him in. And according to the arresting report, he then said, "I told you I had to go, you stupid cop." It was on the way to the Collier County Sheriff's Office that DeFalco informed one of the deputies that he needed to use the bathroom. The deputy reported in his report that he told DeFalco to, quote, "try and hold it like an adult," which obviously he did not. Officer Sean Harper said, "Unfortunately, it's pretty common for people to urinate, defecate, or vomit while in a police car. Sometimes it's because of their condition, sometimes it's in protest, and sometimes it's just in spite." Wow. I wasn't aware of how common this was. You know, somewhere is a poor schlub at the police garage who has to regularly clean out these vehicles. Must love his work. Anyway, a couple of least competent criminals to share with you here. Number one, the thief who snatched the brand new bike from Wheelworks in Belmont, Massachusetts in August got away, but police saw surveillance photos of him when he returned to the store 2 hours later and asked to see some locks, presumably so that he could secure the bike he had just stolen. Incredulous employees gave chase, but the thief ran faster. And number two, Kristen DeCosta, age 30, was charged with 17 recent burglaries around Somerset, Massachusetts in August. Now, according to Police Chief Joseph Fiorera, DeCosta is perhaps the only perp ever to not understand that since she was wearing a GPS ankle monitor from an earlier arrest, all 17 break-ins were tracked. You know, I was really torn about that second one, Kristen DeCosta, with the ankle bracelet. I mean, this is a classic idiot of the day type story, but still, I didn't make her the idiot of the day. That's because this next story is the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
An undercover officer in Seattle, Washington, made a call to a 20-year-old man and offered to buy some meth. After some negotiation, the two men met and allegedly worked out the details. Here's a direct quote from the cop's own report. "Because the suspect and I had over 30 minutes of conversation via text message, photo calls, and in-person conversation, I made the determination that he was going to sell me illegal narcotics and watched as he smoked illegal narcotics. He then signaled other officers to come in and make the arrest. All in all, a pretty standard case, other than the way the officers discovered the dealer. They found a flyer posted that said, 'Call me if you need meth.' So they called the number given, and the man is now in custody." Now, why would someone post flyers in town asking if people wanted to buy meth, never thinking that the cops might read said flyers? Well, one reason, and one reason only. He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0160. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And once again, that's number 0160. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Guests of the Stuff File program stay at their own homes.
Trust me, I'm the voice for this program. I know there's no budget for accommodations. I'm reading this on a futon.